Part 5. May. Just three houses, May says, and a conversation about a bold move. It's like a film, says Marguerite. She's supposed to be working, but the cafe is quiet, so she's pulled up a chair next to May's so May can tell her the whole story. Marguerite smiles now, as if she's finished a good meal. She takes a sip of May's flat white. I like romantic stories, she says. Well, says May, I've only been here a month. We don't know if it's a romance yet.
This is it, says Marguerite. This is when it's romantic. Nothing is romantic after a few months.
She sits back contemplatively, taking another sip of May's coffee.
Yes, she says. A good story. The part in which you became a drug addict, and then the uplifting ending, with you about to attend university here in the Netherlands.
I'm not there yet. I've only just applied.
Oh, yes? Where to?
Maastricht, Erasmus, Leiden, Amsterdam.
Doing philosophy. It's actually cheaper to study here than in the UK, did you know that? It could work out really well.
That's if they accept me, I mean.
A customer comes in and stands at the counter. Marguerite looks up at the woman, then rolls her eyes at May. The customer looks embarrassed.
I'd better go, Marguerite says.
Thanks for the chat, May says. I'm going to meet Armand at the Van Gogh Museum.
I doubt you will enjoy it, Marguerite says, getting up and going back to the counter. Van Gogh is not a very good painter.
But it's not so crowded at this time of year. You probably won't have to spend long there.
May drains her cup of coffee and checks her phone. She has a message from Armand.
Hey, May, Leniel. See you at 3, okay? Under the sunflowers. Kiss.
And her dad, who wants to visit. About time I gave this Frenchman of yours the once over. I jest, of course. The words cheese, garlic, and surrender will not pass my lips. May won't reply to her dad for now. He only wants to visit because Keiko has dumped him.
She wanted me to move out of my flat, he said, outraged, because it gives her some imaginary condition, and buy somewhere else with her, on the ground floor. I told her hell would freeze over before Alistair Lewarne descended to ground level, ground zero, as I called it.
No, Dad, said May, you can't call it that.
She'll be back, said May's dad.
Will she? Isn't she dating someone else?
It won't last, May's dad said. She stayed with me all these years, drinking and, socializing with other women and whatnot, because of those things. She likes the unpredictability, the excitement. This new Jeremy is a nice guy, by all accounts. Ha, that'll get boring.
What if she doesn't come back? May said. Would you move out of the flat for her? At this, May's dad talked loudly and quickly about May's mother's name being on the lease and tax loopholes and property markets and other complicated reasons he couldn't actually move out. Then he sighed and said, with what sounded almost like a tearful note in his voice, that May should come back to Kuala Lumpur.
We had a bloody great time, didn't we? He said. Father and daughter. That's how it should be.
Are you drunk? May asked.
I've been drinking, her dad said haughtily. I am not drunk.
Dad, said May, this is ridiculous. You miss Keiko. Go and talk to her. I know you can't afford an apartment as fancy as the one Mum's paying for, so move somewhere less fancy. Keiko would appreciate it.
You don't know women, May, her dad said.
I am a woman, May said.
You know what I mean, her dad said.
Not really, but never mind.
Keiko's not with you for money. You're the one who's obsessed with money. You're the one who couldn't decide between an actual human female who likes you and a stupid apartment.
40th floor, said her dad,
with a pool.
May sighed.
I'll give it some thought, her dad said.
Also, have you called your mother?
She's phoned me. Very upset about you doing a runner to the lands of Nev.
Seems like there's some trouble at her work, too. Her buddy, Dr. Ali, stitched her up, apparently. Some whistleblowing antics. You really ought to speak to her.
I will, May said. Just not yet. She felt guilty then about what she'd said to Dr. Ali. When Dr. Ali had appeared at the clinic, just before May's follow-up appointment, May thought she'd been sent by Louise. Then she realized she hadn't. She wanted to say to Dr. Ali, why didn't she send you? She wanted Dr. Ali to say, you should call your mum. But Dr. Ali didn't do that. She seemed to have her own problems. She half-dragged May back outside and asked May a lot of questions. Then she seemed shocked at most of May's answers. May wondered if she was officially shocking now, if this was the start of her new life, shocking people. May had remembered more about Dr. Ali as she talked. It came back to May that they'd met at one of her mum's parties when she was a kid, and Dr. Ali had come out to the garden. May couldn't remember what she and Dr. Ali talked about that night, but she remembered Dr. Ali looking back towards the house at the party happening behind the glass doors. Dr. Ali was looking at May's mum. She'd had this wondering look, as if she was looking at the northern lights. Starstruck, May thought. She'd heard her mum mention Dr. Ali since then as her best employee. Capable, bullshit-free. Loyal, perceptive. Not that perceptive, thought May. Remembering it, she felt obscurely angry. She wanted to strike out at this unperceptive doctor's picture of her mother, scribble the eyes out, draw an evil moustache on it, devil horns, wave it in Dr. Ali's face. So she told Dr. Ali what her mum was actually like. And Dr. Ali looked shocked again. The stupid thing was, almost as soon as May had spoken, and she could tell that Dr. Ali listened to her, with this horrified but also strangely comprehending expression, she regretted it. It's all true, she reminds herself. But still, she wished she hadn't said it. She wanted to get away then from Dr. Ali, as if leaving the scene would undo the crime. What happened after that? Dr. Ali started reminiscing about some embarrassing kid thing, May said. May almost wanted to ask her if she was okay, but it was obvious she wasn't. When Dr. Ali left, she walked away slowly, as if fatally stricken. May felt stricken herself. Loyal, May thinks. The word makes her feel unhappy. You really ought to speak to her. May's conversation with her dad was a couple of weeks ago. May still feels the same way now. I will. Not yet. May hasn't answered her mum's calls or read the emails from her. She loves her mother. She's angry with her mother. She loves her mother. She can't trust her mother. Her thoughts go round like that a lot. Sometimes she thinks that her mum couldn't bear to see May, via her first romance, becoming more independent. When May thinks this,
She pictures the woman whose photograph she sees in the papers sometimes, Dr. Louise Nightingale, walking out of the Nepenthe headquarters in London in a steel-grey suit, expressionless. The doctor with her hands on her hips, supervising the tipping of chemicals into the water supply. She's pretty sure, though, that the main reason her mum wanted May to wipe her memory was so that what Louise said about May's birth mother would be swept away too. More than that, she thinks her mum would do it again. If she had the opportunity to put a headset on May while May was sleeping and wipe the memory all over again, May thinks her mum would probably find a way to justify that. But did her mum want the deletion to spare herself or May? And where was the line between the two of them anyway? May's mum was pained by May's pain. To comfort herself, she had to comfort May. And sometimes May thinks that maybe her mum didn't know why she did what she did. That for a moment she wasn't Dr. Louise Nightingale, but a normal person, doing something without understanding why she was doing it. And if she'd acted according to her own unconscious fears, her fear of losing her daughter's love, of May moving out of reach, could that be forgivable? And then she pictures her mum reading to her in the light of the revolving birds, or crying at the airport, saying, "My beautiful plum." Maybe all of this can be true, except the contamination of the water supply. Probably. May thinks about her birth mother sometimes. She feels sorry for the woman whose circumstances were so desperate she had to give her baby up. Or maybe had to give birth to a baby she never wanted. Before, May had been so horrified at being like her birth mother, weak, addicted, unstable, that she didn't even consider that maybe her birth mother didn't start like that either, that she'd just taken that shape to fit into the space that was available. May, and at times she feels guilty about this, and about not wanting to track her mother down, has more space. May's not so worried, either, that she's going to repeat the same story. She doesn't believe in story, for a start. She doesn't really believe in strong or weak anymore, not when it comes to people. Maybe she's turning into a true Sartrean after all. With Humean overtones. Not that she'll ever tell her mum that. It's not like May plans on ignoring her mum forever or anything. She even knows what she'll say to her when they finally do talk. Something about having spent her life being scared of bold moves, longing to make one, but feeling that she didn't have what it took. And she didn't get it right at first. She thought that her bold move was geographic, London to Kuala Lumpur, to Crowshill, to Amsterdam. But that wasn't it. Then she thought it was romantic. Her turning up here, finding Armand standing on a ladder, hanging up Christmas lights. "Want a hand?" she said, like she was in a film and it was ending happily. But that wasn't it either. She's enjoying the May and Armand film, but it's not the end. She doesn't know how it's going to end. Right now, she wants to be with him, have a lot of sex, get married, have children, die in the same bed in their old people's home. But if they don't, May will get over it. "It turned out," May will say to her mum, "that my boldest move was just doing something you didn't want me to do. And then she did it anyway. And, just like Armand said, there was this sense of things being calm. Unknown, but okay. Like going over a waterfall and landing in a deep pool. Maybe she'll swim to shore. Maybe she'll flail around and sink to the bottom and have to struggle back up. But she's not going to float. Something like that. That's what she'll say. For now, she's just enjoying having a bit of time to herself. She puts on her coat and scarf, picks up her bag, opens her umbrella, and goes out into the sudden rain and cold, feeling the ceiling lift off her, flying out and away in cloud swirls, like the Van Gogh paintings she may or may not enjoy, thinking, this...